Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses what we've learned from the recently released Bush-era torture memos and the need to hold government officials accountable for the commission of war crimes. Yifat Suskind of the women's rights group Madre, who talks about her group's opposition to President Obama's escalation of the Afghan war and concerns about the increasing oppression of women there. And Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses President Obama's statements at the recent Summit of the Americas, indicating a possible thaw in U.S.-Cuban and Venezuelan relations. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a decade of intense anti-insurgency operations in Chechnya, Russia has declared it will withdraw 20,000 soldiers and end its state of emergency in the predominantly Muslim province. Today, separatist Islamic rebels are disorganized, with many living in mountain hideouts or in exile. Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov, an ally of Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, hopes to rebuild with billions in aid from Moscow and investment from oil-rich nations in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. According to the Christian Science Monitor, human rights groups, highly critical of Russian military tactics in Chechnya, say opposition activists are subject to abduction and torture. In 2004, the Russian Rights Monitor Memorial says over 200,000 civilians were killed in the two Russian incursions into Chechnya, along with 40,000 Russian soldiers. Tatiana Lokshina of Human Rights Watch in Russia observed, "Today, human rights abuses are committed by pro-Moscow Chechens rather than Russian security forces, but the atmosphere of impunity is the same." Thanks to an obscure provision for alternative fuels in 2005 transportation legislation, big pulp and paper companies could gain an $8 billion windfall from U.S. taxpayers this year. Since the 1930s, most paper mills have made paper from wood chips. The factory process creates a black sludge that is rich in carbon and used to provide energy for the paper plants. But now, by adding diesel fuel to the mix, the paper companies qualify for a mixed fuel tax credit. In late March, International Paper announced it had received its first monthly check from the IRS for $716 million. Before the tax credit, paper companies were one of the biggest industrial emitters of greenhouse gases, behind steel and chemical factories. Last fall, the Joint Committee on Taxation in Congress estimated a three-month extension of the mixed fuel credit would cost taxpayers $61 million. According to The Nation magazine, the real cost of the extension was $2 billion. Tax credit is set to expire at the end of 2009. Yet there has been little outrage or action on Capitol Hill over how influential paper companies are exploiting the diesel tax credit. Caroline Kennedy and two other American Roman Catholics have been rejected by the Vatican as potential U.S. ambassadors to the Holy See. These ambassadorial candidates were seen by the Vatican as unacceptable, reports the Guardian newspaper, due to their support for abortion rights and lifting the ban on stem cell research. Also rejected was Douglas Kimmeck, a professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University and former head of the Office of Legal Counsel for Republican Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Conservative American Catholics called the nomination of Caroline Kennedy inappropriate and a calculated insult at the Holy See. Kennedy had been a candidate to fill the Senate seat of Hillary Clinton and is a close ally of Barack Obama. Conservatives are also upset that Catholic University Notre Dame has invited President Obama to speak in May and will give the 44th president an honorary degree. A recent Gallup poll found rank-and-file American Catholics are more moderate than the Catholic bishops on a variety of issues, including 63% believing that embryonic stem cell research is morally acceptable. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After a heated debate among his advisors, President Obama released memos from Bush administration officials detailing their authorization of interrogation techniques used against terrorist suspects held by the U.S. that are widely acknowledged as acts of torture. The memos, released on April 16th, describe the use of waterboarding or drowning techniques used on two al-Qaeda suspects on 266 occasions, up to six times a day in one case. CIA interrogators also subjected 14 high-level U.S.-held prisoners to sleep deprivation, forced nudity, and the use of painful positions. The president declared that he would not prosecute CIA personnel who participated in torture and who had relied on Bush administration legal opinions issued after the September 11th attacks. But Mr. Obama left the door open to possible future criminal prosecution of the Bush administration architects of the interrogation techniques that violated both U.S. and international law. The president said it would be up to his Attorney General Eric Holder on whether or not to prosecute these officials and urged that any congressional investigation be organized in a bipartisan fashion. Former Vice President Dick Cheney and Bush CIA Director Michael Hayden have both criticized the release of the torture memos, asserting that the information will be useful to al-Qaeda. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who discusses what we've learned from the recently released torture memos and the need to hold government officials accountable for the commission of war crimes.
Well, you know, some of the outlines of what was in these memos was well known. The legal arguments justifying torture under, you know, very bad legal reasoning. The arguments that you needed organ failure to amount to torture. Those kind of arguments we've seen before. What was important about this memo were, I guess, a couple of them. One that came out, which we hadn't seen, which applied the specific torture techniques to one particular detainee, Abu Zubaydah. And it went through in detail the kinds of techniques that could be used against Abu Zubaydah with all kinds of, like, junk language to try and justify that you could actually torture Abu Zubaydah, and included such things, which we'd seen some of in the Red Cross reports, but to see it laid down by an official of the U.S. government, in this case, Bybee, who is now a current sitting federal judge in the Ninth Circuit, to see Bybee, whose memo, which was also probably written by you as well, which tells how to torture Abu Zubaydah, how many minutes water can be poured in his mouth, how long he can be put into a small box, how insect can be introduced, but it can't be told that it could sting him to death because that would actually clearly violate, and then there's no way around it, prohibition on torture. But it all did, the whole set of it. And then in a couple of other memos which were released that took place in 2005, which were by Stephen Bradbury. And that was new, because we thought when Stephen Bradbury took over the Office of Legal Counsel from Bybee, and really you, essentially, that he had maybe reformed the office a little bit. But when you read those memos, he didn't. He didn't at all. And those memos indicate some amazing facts, that Abu Zubaydah was waterboarded, or suffocation by water, as the Red Cross calls it, 83 times, and that colleague Sheikh Mohammed, 183 times. So that the idea that this was set forth in memos, it's the most chilling reading you can imagine, really some of the worst documents, I think, to ever come out in the U.S. democracy that I've ever seen. And that's why I think we're getting sort of a mixed message. The positive part of this, if you can say that, is that Obama was willing to release these four memos. Of course, we want him to release much more. We want him not to take the state secrets defense in all of our lawsuits and the ACLU's lawsuits, which this administration, the Obama administration, has been doing. But it is a pretty big step. And as we can talk about, he did go to the CIA to try and discuss that step on Monday of this week.
Has the Obama administration, Michael, left the door open to investigation and prosecution of these high-level Bush administration advisors who were the architects of the torture policy?
You would have to say that to the extent the handwriting is on the wall, it says there's not going to be any kind of prosecution. That's for a number of reasons. One is that two of the people involved in at least the CIA torture secret site work are working for Obama right now and giving him advice. And secondly, Obama has indicated in the kinds of statements he makes, we should not look backward, we should not seek retribution, that he believes that we should maybe expose some of the stuff and then just turn the page, and that his promise not to torture again is sufficient. And just makes no sense at all. It makes no sense because it doesn't deter people in the future. And you have Hayden and Cheney out there, you know, beating the bushes to say torture, torture, torture.
Michael, we all kind of heard the news a couple weeks back where Spanish judge Baltasar Garzon had indicated he was going to be possibly opening up an investigation into at least six of these Bush administration architects of the torture memos. It looks now like the Spanish judge Baltasar Garzon has been at least impeded from following through on his stated objective of opening an investigation by the Spanish Attorney General. Do you have an update for us on that situation?
Scott, that was one of the more exciting moments I've had in the last few weeks, when Garzon opened the investigation of the six lawyers. On the other hand, there are efforts now going on in Spain to try and kill that prosecution off. It's not so easy to do. The Attorney General, or I guess the Chief Prosecutor of Spain, said he didn't believe it should go forward, but Garzon has independent authority for it to go forward. And the latest we've heard is he has referred it up to his other fellow investigating judges to decide what to do, whether he should continue being the investigating judge or whether another investigating judge, I think there's six altogether, or eight, possibly six, should do it. The one thing I can say is it would be a shame if Garzon was not ultimately the one who did this case, because it was, as we know from the Pinochet case, he's the aggressive judge who will really go after people. The other judges, I fear, not that they'll be politically pushed that much, but that they'll be slow about going about it. And the biggest thing that could happen here, and the most important, is that the Spanish case, or a case similar possibly in another country like Italy or somewhere else, goes forward. Because what that does is that sends a message to the United States: you can't get away with giving impunity to the torturers. And it also says to the torturers, you can't travel to 25 countries in Europe. But the final word is not in on the Spanish prosecutions. Right now, what we're awaiting is a decision by the fellow investigating judges of Garzon as to whether the case should go forward and who should handle it. My guess is it will go forward. The question is whether Garzon will handle it. He is by far the best judge to handle it.
That was Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and author of the book, The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld, A Prosecution by Book. Contact the center by calling area code 212-614-6464 or visit their website at ccrjustice.org. Afghan women, long excluded from any public role, have become more visible in recent days. A law regulating family life for the nation's Shiite minority was passed by the Afghan legislature and signed into law by President Hamid Karzai, even though critics, both Afghan women and foreign heads of state, said the law essentially legalized rape within marriage. Karzai has, for the moment, blocked implementation of the law. To emphasize their opposition, hundreds of women marched in Kabul in mid-April, standing up to insults and physical attacks from outraged Afghan men. Last month, a group of Afghan women organized several thousand of their sisters to publicly mark International Women's Day on March 8th with a nationwide strike. However, a key women's rights activist, Sitara Achaksai, a member of Kandahar's provincial council, was murdered on April 12th. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Yifat Suskind, communications director with the U.S.-based women's rights organization Madre, which is about to launch a campaign to protect the rights of Afghan women activists. She discusses Madre's opposition to President Barack Obama's deployment of an additional 21,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan and Madre's views on negotiating with the Taliban.
There are a few reasons for the resurgence of the Taliban, and ironically, one of the biggest reasons is the presence of U.S. and NATO troops in Afghanistan. And to the extent that people in Afghanistan see the U.S. and NATO troops as an illegitimate foreign occupation, and that's happening more and more as the U.S. is, you know, recklessly using weapons that kill civilians. The more civilians in Afghanistan that are killed, and those figures are at record numbers right now, but the more civilians that are killed, the more people in Afghanistan are driven to support the Taliban because they see that as a legitimate resistance against a very brutal and callous foreign occupation led by the United States. The United States has also backed a government that is riddled with people whose human rights record is just as bad as the Taliban's, arguably. You know, people who we once called the Northern Alliance, you know, these gangs of warlords and organized criminals who also have used, you know, systematic campaigns of rape and robbery and, you know, terrorizing communities in order to maintain a hold on power. About 60% of the Afghan parliament right now has ties to warlords, and this is the government that is, you know, heavily backed by the U.S. So people see the Taliban as, you know, a sort of law and order force, you know, a very, very rigid rule when the Taliban is in charge. But at least if you don't step at all out of line, you know, you can be safe to go about your business during the day. We would really like to see the Obama administration sort of chart a whole new course in U.S.-Afghan relations. And I think that people in this country supported Barack Obama because they also believe that the U.S. needs to really engage with the rest of the world, not just occupy it. The U.S. ultimately doesn't have any right to be in Afghanistan.
Eva Tsuskind, I think most Americans think of Afghan women as always having been horribly oppressed and marginalized. But I've met quite a few Afghan women in the U.S. who are professionals, you know, doctors, lawyers, even engineers. So while Afghans in general weren't happy with the Soviet occupation of the 1980s, at least that was the time when women had more freedom.
You know, one of the things that we've learned from Afghan women that we've talked to is that, you know, since the mid-1800s, Afghan governments have very slowly but steadily advanced progressive reforms in that country. And there's always been a big tension in Afghanistan between a central government that hasn't been very strong or far-reaching and these relatively more powerful local leaders. Local leaders often have been opposed to projects of modernization and progressive reform because it means a dilution of their power. People have always been contending with that tension, but before the U.S. funded the creation of the Taliban in Afghanistan, in the years and decades before that, women comprised, in the cities, in Kabul especially, more than half of all students and teachers at the university, about half of all government workers were women. 40% of doctors were women, and about 70% of all school teachers. So, you know, women were highly educated, a vibrant force in public life. You know, that's Kabul. That's a very different picture than out in the countryside, where for the most part, these kind of tribal structures have always dominated, and women have had very little access to, you know, education or economic participation or human rights.
During the civil war that followed the Soviet withdrawal and the 5 years or so that the Taliban ruled Afghanistan, that is until late 2001, women did suffer tremendously. Now the Taliban are resurgent, and some groups are calling for the U.S. to negotiate with the Taliban to end the war. Does Madre have a position on that?
We do have a position on negotiations, and I want to preface it by just saying that our underlying position is that what happens in Afghanistan and the shape of peace talks there shouldn't be decided, you know, either in the Madre office or by the U.S. public or by, you know, U.S. officials in Washington, D.C. So, you know, when I say that Madre has a position, our position is to listen carefully to the voices of progressive Afghan women who we're supporting and try to amplify their message here in the U.S. And the message that we have heard from women who are struggling in Afghanistan for, you know, rights to education for women and girls and reproductive health and, you know, a viable, meaningful peace in that country is that broad-based negotiations need to happen. They need to include the Taliban because of the fact that that is one of the political formations in that country, like them or not. And negotiations need to include also, you know, what's called civil society, you know, organizations of people who are coming together to advance human rights and education and health care and these kinds of reforms. In particular, the women's movement, which represents, you know, a very, very disproportionately progressive force in Afghan society, I think is going to be key to a viable peace settlement. And, you know, one of the things we have to remember about human rights is that they are rights, and rights are not negotiable. So what we don't want to see in Afghanistan is what we've seen so many times before, which is human rights, in particular women's rights, being traded for political cooperation. Those are not negotiations that we would support or that we think will lead to a viable peace.
That was Ifat Tsuskind, Communications Director with Madre. Contact the group by calling area code 212-627-0444 or visit their website at madre.org. During the recent 34-nation Summit of the Americas held in Trinidad and Tobago, President Obama struck a very different tone than his predecessor George Bush in dealing with U.S. adversaries Cuba and Venezuela. In advance of the meeting, Mr. Obama announced the lifting of all restrictions on Cuban Americans' travel to Cuba and remittances sent to family members on the island. These developments were welcomed among most Latin American nations that strongly favor a lifting of the 47-year U.S. Cold War-era economic embargo against Cuba. Cuban President Raúl Castro responded to Obama's loosening of restrictions with an indication of his willingness to discuss issues important to Washington, such as the release of political prisoners and a reduction of fees charged on remittances sent by Americans to relatives in Cuba. An impromptu 7-second handshake at the summit, where Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez gave Mr. Obama a book by Edward Galeano titled Open Veins of Latin America, 5 Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent, momentarily eased tensions between the nations with the likely exchange of ambassadors that had been previously recalled. Conservative critics predictably reacted with anger at Obama's new conciliatory approach on U.S.-Latin American relations. Senator John Ensign, Republican of Nevada, attacked Obama's handshake with Chavez as irresponsible. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses Obama's actions at the summit and the obstacles to a possible thaw in U.S., Cuban, and Venezuelan relations.
Well, I don't think there's really much there. I think it was good in the sense that Obama showed that he was willing to listen. And he showed that he had a different attitude than Bush. You know, in the images that flashed around the world, front page of the New York Times of Obama shaking hands with Chavez and laughing and joking with him, it really inflamed the right wing here in the United States and around the world. But I don't think that there was necessarily any substantive change. And I think the reason is more structural.
How do you mean structural? What are the U.S. interests or corporate interests in the region that you think may prevent a thawing of relations?
Well, you know, it isn't even corporate. It's ironically, it's more narrow than that. It's just a kind of a foreign policy establishment that still sees Latin America as belonging to the United States and hasn't really recognized the huge changes that have taken place over the last 10 years. You know, the one sign of this, if you look at Obama's advisors, Jeffrey Davidoff, who was a career Foreign Service officer, was in Chile in the embassy, U.S. embassy, in the coup back in 1973, served under Reagan and Nixon. And he's the guy who Obama chose to organize the summit. He was special ambassador for the summit. And he was immediately talking to the press right after Obama shook hands with Chavez, trying to do, I don't know what you call the opposite of damage control. Maybe you could call it repair control. And he was insulting Chavez. He's trying to provoke him. That's what they do this a lot, actually. And Chavez usually takes the bait, unfortunately. He said, well, you know, Chavez just wanted to get close to Obama because Obama is more popular in Venezuela than Chavez is. You know, he made it clear, as he did before the summit, too, that nothing's going to change. I think until Obama gets rid of people like him, you're not going to see very much. In foreign policy, there's no real pressure. You know, there's no political constituency that has a real voice, especially in the media, that can pressure the foreign policy establishment to change. You know, we're kind of like Russia in the sense of, you know, on foreign policy issues, we don't have an independent civil society that has access to the media for the most part. Even though most Americans would like to see better relations with the rest of the world, including Latin America, and they have no stake in the embargo or bad relations with Chavez or anything else, you find here is Obama, you know, leaving the decisions to these people who are really, in Davidoff's case, he's practically a neoconservative.
Mark, we see in terms of some of the pre-conference dialogue going on between Barack Obama and Raúl Castro that the U.S. Was willing to ease up on the remittances being sent from Cuban Americans to their families in Cuba, as well as expanding the visits that they can take to the island to visit family. But of course, the big issue here is the 47-year embargo. Do you think any changes to the embargo can be made here in Barack Obama's first term, given the influence that Cuban Americans have traditionally had in a key electoral state such as Florida? But of course, we also understand that attitudes are changing among Cuban Americans, that more are now in favor of constructive engagement towards Havana than the older generation, which is losing ground.
Well, first of all, I think the lifting of the travel restrictions and the remittance restrictions and some of the telecom restrictions, that's something that the right-wing Cuban-American groups in Florida, at least the most important ones, agree with. So that was not controversial, and that was something that didn't cost Obama anything. And that's, I think, as far as he's going to go, because he doesn't want to take the risk that Florida could end up being a swing state again in the next presidential election. Now, that doesn't mean it stops there, because Congress has a different attitude. The majority of Congress wants to lift the travel restrictions as the next step for everybody in the United States. So you might still see some further progress, but it won't come from, it doesn't look like it's going to come from the administration, again, unless he decides to get rid of his current advisors and get a new set of advisors. With regard to the Cuban-American Florida, it's true, opinions are changing, attitudes have changed for quite a while. But I think the right-wing Cuban-American groups, Cuban-American National Foundation, for example, they're more organized, they have money, and the older Cuban-Americans who are more conservative vote in greater numbers than the younger ones. So if you just look at the polls, yeah, you do have, for the first time, a slight majority, that wants to lift the entire embargo. But that isn't enough for a cautious politician to say, okay, we can move ahead now in response to popular opinion, even in the Cuban-American community.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Contact the center by calling area code 202-293-5380 or visit their website at cepr.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.